Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, hour three, let's do it. The number is 888-914-9149. I have room for you right now if you call. The lines are chronically full, but right now we do have a line or two open, so give it a shot, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Caesar now in Los Angeles. Hi, Caesar, or is it Cesar?
Either or can work, Patrick.
Okay.
Good morning. I have a question. I am a servant of our Lord at my local parish. I am in formation to be a catechist, and I'm faced with a situation where a family member outside of the U.S., they're, let's just say, celebrating getting together with someone of the same marriage. They're the some of the closest family.
Of the same marriage? What do you mean, of the same marriage?
Of the same, I apologize, of the same sex.
Ah, okay.
Of the same sex. So I am intrigued. I am looking for some enlightenment here on how to approach the situation, because they're definitely going to invite me, and I know what the right thing is, but I need some help here on how not to hurt their feelings of, you know, not attending.
Well, I wouldn't be too worried about that. You know, they should be far more worried about the serious sin that they're going to be committing by doing this. If I were you, I would just say, I can't attend the wedding because I don't, it's not a wedding. You're not getting married. Even though legally, sure, the state would say that you are. In the eyes of God, you're not. You're committing a serious sin. So I'm sorry. I love you. I wish I could be there to support you, but I can't do so under the circumstances. And here's okay. Why I would say that. Not because you're not loving and compassionate. We should always be loving and compassionate. But there's also a time when you have to be forthright. And it's not that you want to brutalize anybody or you want to offend somebody. But when you speak the truth in love, inevitably, in some cases, they will be offended. And that's a good thing, because it might be the thing necessary to jar them out of their fantasy world that they're living in. And it may be that you're the only person who has the gumption to just say, no, I'm sorry, what you're doing is wrong. I can't be part of it. Maybe you're the only person who will say that. And so even though it's, you know, hard on you, I'm sure, and people will get riled and you'll be called a hater and a bigot and a homophobe and all that nonsense, none of which is true. Nonetheless, it could be a John the Baptist moment for you, where, as you know the story, Cesar, that St. John the Baptist was publicly denouncing Herod for marrying his brother's wife. And he publicly denounced him, and he got him thrown into prison. And you know how the story goes, that it wound up costing him his head, because he was killed for speaking the truth. But that didn't stop him. And I'm sure he knew where things were going to go in due time, that eventually he would probably be killed. I'm pretty sure he probably knew that. And he spoke fearlessly. And he was probably the only person who spoke up fearlessly. So you're not going to get your head chopped off, obviously, but you might take a few hits from people who don't like you anymore because you're speaking the truth in love.
Amen. Amen. How about my family members who go? Are they committing any direction for attending?
I could not go in good conscience for two reasons. One would be that I would be materially contributing to or participating in something that someone else is doing that's sinful. And the other thing is, it would be a cause of scandal, because by my going there, it would effectively be, it's not even tantamount to, it is actually saying, you know, to heck with God, to heck with what Jesus taught, to heck with the Holy Bible, to heck with the Catholic Church, I'm going to go celebrate something that is a perversion. That's a real scandal. So the sad thing is that all of the people in the family who love each other and want to be there. And this is this. Understand what I'm saying here, Caesar. This is an example of where people can fall into the idolatry of family relationships and wanting to be liked and wanting to go to a nice party above God. And if you worship anything other than God himself, if you, or put it this way, if you place anything else higher than God and you serve that when you know that doing that is going to conflict with your loving relationship with God, then you are now an idolater because you have placed something in the place of God. And that is a grievous sin. So I think many people, they don't really think it through, and they think, oh, I'm just being nice, I'm just being supportive, God understands, and all the ways in which people try to rationalize things like that and go and participate. But in fact, that's what's really happening here. As sad as it is.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I thought so, but you know, I needed some enlightenment. I kept praying to God for some enlightenment. I appreciate your response.
You got it. You got it, Caesar. And I know it's a difficult road to go down. I myself haven't had to go down that road. As far as I know, I hope I never will, but it's possible. Anything is possible in this life. So remember, here's one final thing, Caesar. Remember that the word martyr, from the Greek word martus, it means a witness. And there are many people who are martyrs because they witness to the truth and they suffer as a result of it. Now, the ultimate, of course, would be to give your life for the truth. So maybe for all the people who are listening right now who are in the situation of your family members who are thinking, well, yeah, I know it's a, you know, same-sex wedding and I'm still going to go and all that, just ask yourself, at what point do you say, I will not compromise my belief in Jesus Christ, even if you have to kill me? I'm not going to compromise it. And then step back and realize, look at how little this is for. That you're willing to compromise your faith in Jesus for something so insignificant as this?
Right.
I don't mean you. I just mean the people who go along to get along. It's easy. Water flows downhill, doesn't it? Water seeks the path of least resistance. And very often people find themselves in the same situation where they're just going to do the easy thing. And more often than not, the difficult thing is to say, as much as I would like to do this, and as much as I know it's going to cost me by not doing this, I can't. Because if I do this, I will be compromising what I know to be true. It'll be a form of betrayal of Jesus. And I can't do that. And that's where the suffering begins.
Absolutely. I even felt it heavier since I'm in catechist formation. I'm like, I have to preach what I pray. I can. I'm going to hurt some people. I know it, but I'd rather be right with Jesus than with the world.
Yeah, it's true. Very true.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call, and I hope that our conversation is helpful to others. Here's a verse, everybody, when you are in this situation, like Cesar was just describing. Matthew chapter 5, verse 10, write it down, because sooner or later you're going to need this, and you're going to want to pray this passage and think about it because it applies to you. Matthew 5, verse 10 and 11, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, and for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so men persecuted the prophets who were before you. Matthew 5, 10 through 12 there. So keep that in your back pocket. Chances are you're going to find yourself in a situation. I mean, if you're a for real follower of Jesus Christ, if you're like really sold out for Jesus and you've picked up your cross and you're denying yourself and you're following Jesus and you're seeking to be faithful, this is going to happen to you at some point. So just be prepared. And Jesus says, you're blessed when this happens. You're blessed when they revile you and they, oh, you're just a homophobe. You're just a bigot. How could you be so cruel? You can't even attend their wedding. How terrible. Jesus says, rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. You don't seek that. None of us does. But it will find you. If you're a for real follower of Jesus, those situations will find you. It's inevitable. Let's go to Michelle now in Chicago. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question regarding the various rites of the Catholic Church. Can you explain why it is they are all legitimate and just how they formed?
Sure. There's a great little book. It's called These Are My Rites. I bought it a long time ago. I think it's still in print. So if you want a book-length explanation of it, that would be a good place. It's not very long, by the way. Okay. So the rites or particular churches, they're sometimes called, these are expressions of the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, universal, in different localities. So keeping in mind that the church started in Jerusalem and the very first Mass was celebrated either in Hebrew or Aramaic. It wasn't Greek, it wasn't Latin, but it was either Hebrew or Aramaic. And as the apostles began to fan out in doing what Jesus said, to go into the whole world to make disciples of all nations, they would establish the church in all these places that they went to. St. Thomas, for example, he went as far as India, and he died there as a martyr. So he brought the faith, the gospel, to a very far-flung place. And all the apostles, in their own way, other than, say, St. James, who died early on, they did the same. So as the faith began to take root in these various lands, the customs and the languages, for example, Greek and much of the world, but other languages as well, they began to form their own way of celebrating the Mass. And in the East, they call it the Divine Liturgy. So certain customs, certain ways of singing and ways of celebrating the Mass, and I'm just using some liturgical things specifically. There were other things, but here we see the way in which this organic development of the universal church, the Catholic Church, in these various places began to take on unique characteristics and unique traits. It was still the church, it was still the Catholic faith, but the ways of expressing it began to become unique from place to place. So in the West, it was Latin. In the East, it was Greek. So what happened was, by the time you get to the 11th century, there is this terrible schism in the church, and what we think of today as the Greek Orthodox churches, the Orthodox churches, they broke away from the Catholic Church, and there was a definitive break of communion, and they claimed to be autocephalic. In other words, they were the patriarchs of these various churches. They claimed to be the head of that Eastern church, and they were no longer living in communion with the Catholic Church as a whole. So what happened was, in many cases, fast forward from the 11th century, fast forward to the 16th century, 17th century, it really was more in the 17th century, that you see whole groups of people from those Eastern churches wanting to return to communion with the Catholic Church and being received back into communion. And the result was a unification of these groups. Now, not the whole Eastern Church, but a group of people within that church. And when they came back into union with the Catholic Church, they were permitted, rightly so, to preserve their ancient and beautiful way of being Catholic. So they were in union with the Catholic Church once again, but they maintained their liturgical customs and the language, for example. So when you see the rites, and by the rites I'm referring maybe more specifically to the Eastern rites, let's say the Byzantine rite, for example, what you're seeing is what it would look like if all those Orthodox churches came back into communion with the Catholic Church. You're seeing those customs preserved, the language very often preserved, and so on. And yet they are recognized because they truly are Catholics. They're members of the one true church, the Catholic Universal Church, although their expression of the faith, is unique in the ways that I just described. Now, I fear that if I go on too long, your eyes will glaze over. So I'll leave it at that. Does that help clarify it a little bit?
Yeah, it does. You use the word organically, and that kind of puts into question for me Novus Ordo, which started with Vatican II, and that seems not to have come about organically, but rather thrust upon the church. Yeah. And so now also inorganically, the Latin Rite is being taken away from us.
For a time.
And so
that won't last forever. Okay. Here's how, here's why I can say that. Here's why I don't think, I think we're going through a season where there is, for whatever reason, great hostility toward the traditional Latin Mass, but that won't last forever, I don't believe. And here's why I say that, because we saw when, in the case of Pope Benedict the 16th, a 180-degree opposite way of looking at the traditional Mass. He, in his Motu Proprio, Summorum Pontificum, he not only extolled this patrimony of the traditional Latin Mass, and also demonstrated how it can coexist amicably and harmoniously with the new rite of the Mass. And he also encouraged bishops and priests and lay people, for that matter, to avail themselves of the traditional Latin Mass if they so chose. So you can read all about that, and maybe you already have, in his Summorum Pontificum. So now the current Pope, Pope Francis, he has taken the opposite view, and he has effectively completely reversed and abrogated everything that his predecessor said the church should do. Okay, well, this is a way of demonstrating that a future pope could be the next pope, could be the pope after that, I don't know. But a future pope could just as easily reverse everything that Pope Francis has done and say, okay, we're not doing that anymore. And he could go back in the direction of Pope Benedict, and that very possibly may happen. So this is a season that we're living through, and I recognize that there are a lot of uncomfortable things about the season that we're in right now. But we trust in the Lord, and we pray for the Pope, and we remain faithful. And we, you know, if we need to carry this cross for a while, okay, that's what Jesus is asking of us, and we'll do it cheerfully. But I wouldn't lose hope, or I wouldn't become despondent, or, you know, allow distress to overcome you. Just keep marching forward. And the church, ever ancient, ever new, changes in ways that, like we just saw. And it could easily happen again and go back in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Michelle. We should always pray for the Holy Father, right? Pray, pray, pray.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Great talking to you. This would be a perfect time to take a break. My number is 888-914-9149. There's one line open, and if you call now, you can grab it, 888-914-9149. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. You know, we receive over 1 million prayer requests every year, thanks in part to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line, helping us stay connected to your intentions. Learn how our sponsor can support your family with life insurance at relevantradio.com/Forester. In Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, where everyone's a winner. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. Let's go to George now in Temple City, California. Hi, George.
Hi, Patrick. I just have a brief question. I just recently bought a traditional calendar, a traditional Catholic calendar, and it has the Ember Days on it. And I know what Ember Days are, basically, but it also has something called Rogation Days. I've never heard of the term Rogation Days. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, it's it's from the Latin, which means to ask or to petition. And it's a day throughout the life of the church's calendar. There are only a few of them. When you are doing some kind of penance. So it can be, I think more traditionally, it would be fasting. There'd be special prayers attached to it. So they're like mini Lenten days, if you want to think of it that way. a way of asking the Lord to purify you from your sins, asking him to draw you closer. So they're days of petition and, you know, some kind of penance. That's what those are for.
Are they set days, or are they vary or something like that? Or
Now, that's a question I'm not sure if I know the answer to. I know that in the traditional calendar, there were set days. I'd have to go back and look to find out exactly what they were. There are rogation days in the calendar since Vatican II, but I don't know if those are fixed days. I think they might be. I just don't know the answer to that. I'd have to look it up.
Okay, well, no, thanks. That clarifies it for me and all. Yeah, thank you very much.
You got it. Nice to talk to you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Angela now in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So my question is, what day does the Sabbath fall on? Is it Saturday or Sunday?
Saturday. Saturday is the seventh day of the week, biblically speaking, so that's the Sabbath. Sunday is the first day of the week, and that's the Lord's Day. This is why we worship on Sunday instead of the Sabbath. So we as Catholics obey the commandment to keep holy the Sabbath, but the church has the authority given to it by Christ to transfer the observance from the Sabbath day to the first day of the week, because that's the day that Jesus rose from the dead. So you're still observing the commandment, but we're observing the commandment in the new covenant on that day for that reason.
Okay, perfect. You answered my question. I got offered a job, and one of the days is to work on Sunday, and I was kind of conflicted on whether I should take it or not.
Would they give you time to get to Mass before your shift started on Sunday?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a solution there. If you can get to an early Mass before your job starts, that's great. Now, if you run into a situation where they say, well, you got to come in at 6 or something like that, you could always go to Mass the prior evening, go to the vigil Mass on Saturday evening. That would fulfill your Sunday obligation.
Yes, perfect.
Yeah. Now, if you can, I would you know, campaign to not have to work on Sunday. And sometimes employers, once they get to know you and they like you, they may say, okay, sure, we can give you Sundays off. So that would be the ideal if you could not work at all on Sunday. Sometimes it's not possible. So see what you can do.
Yeah, it's actually at a church. So I would, that's why I was kind of confused. Yeah.
So at a Catholic church?
Yes.
Okay. So in that case, it wouldn't be servile work. It wouldn't be the kind of work that you would want to avoid on Sunday to fulfill the commandment to keep this Lord's Day holy. That's a different kind of work. So that's service in form of ministry. So the priest, you know, the priest is working every Sunday. So he's not violating the commandment. And you would be in that same kind of category if you worked at the parish. Let's say you're the choir director, I don't know, or CCD director or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. You answered
But hey,
question.
I just had a thought. If your employer is the church, then why not just go to Mass? Why not just have Mass as part of your job on Sunday?
Yeah, well, I teach CCD for kindergartners, so we do go with Mass with the class, and right after my class ends, we go straight to Mass. So she did, the person in charge did tell me that I could, you know, teach class and then go to Mass and then come back and finish whatever I need to do in the
Problem
office.
Solved. Yeah, sounds like a great situation.
Perfect.
Well, I'm happy for you, Angela. More power to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Tell all your students to listen to the Patrick Madrid Show, and I can help you help them. Thanks. Let's go to Susan now in Wayne, New Jersey. Good morning, Susan.
Hi, Patrick. Can you hear me?
Yes. Welcome.
Hi. I was just wondering, is a Greek Orthodox baptism valid?
Yes. The Greek Orthodox Church's sacraments in general, all of them are valid. And the reason is because they have valid holy orders, valid bishops, and valid priests. And so all of their sacraments are valid.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That was an easy question. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, and it's one of the shortest I've ever given. I'm more given over to giving longer answers. So how about that? Thank you. How about Bill now in Boise, Idaho? Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Hey, I wonder if you would comment on the Mormon Church embracing the same-sex marriage?
Well, I'm sorry that they did that, but it was an announcement that just came out, and that is that the Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is what they like to be called, that they now are on record as supporting a bill to codify same-sex marriage. So I went to the Mormon Church's website and I read in their public affairs office, I read the actual statement from the LDS Church, and it's very, very brief. It's five sentences long, and it simply says we have and we continue to maintain that marriage is between a man and a woman, and we're not going to change that. And yet we also support, for the purposes of preserving people's rights, the laws, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the statement in front of me, but it was very, very terse, and it just simply said, we support this act, this Freedom of Marriage Act, so that people can get married if they wish. And that was it, very succinct. So to my mind, that seems like a compromise, because if you honestly believe, and I do believe they honestly believe, I have no reason not to think that they truly believe that marriage is between one man and one woman, then I don't see how you could say, and yet we're also going to support marriage between two men or two women. It's incongruous. So I think what's happening here is that the Mormon Church is saying that we will acquiesce in terms of saying that it's okay for the state to write its laws in such a way that it recognizes marriage between two men or two women. I don't see how you can square that circle. So it's like having your cake and eating it too. But then again, I'm not a member of the LDS Church, so I don't have any say in the matter. But that's how it comes across to me. So I guess you might say that it's unfortunate, in my view, that they did this. So that's about where it is.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I appreciate that. Let's go to Raphael now in Bozeman, Montana. Good morning, Raphael.
Hey, good morning. I've had a question about the appropriate instruments accompanying the mass. Mm-hmm. This church that I'm thinking of is a very, very much in the general, along with the general instructions. Mm-hmm. But in the ensemble that accompanies the songs along with the mass, they've got a guy playing a snare drum. And I've been around a Catholic church is a heck of a long time in a long life that I, because I'm quite old, I've never heard a snare drum in a music ensemble. What do you think?
Well, personally,
go ahead. Oh, I guess I meant to thank you, and I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, it's okay. No problem at all. I just thought maybe you had more that you wanted to ask. In the Catholic Church, let's not forget, we have 2,000 years now of liturgical history to look at, not to mention biblical history from before the time of the institution of the Catholic Church. And we can see that there is a variation of musical styles from place to place and from time to time. Now, Pope Pius X, he issued an instruction on the kind of music that should be played, or at least sung, in Catholic churches. So he issued this, and I just pulled it up. It's from November 1903. And in this, he gives his instruction on the general principles we should follow when it comes to music, different kinds of sacred music, how the music should reflect the readings, the kind of singing that should be done. And by the way, one of the things that he specifically says you should not do is like operatic singing, where it mimics what you might see at Le Figaro if you were to go to the opera or something like that. He talks there about what kind of instruments are permissible and appropriate, and the pride of place given to an organ in this case. But keep in mind, this was 1903, so the happy clappy guitars and all that kind of stuff was not even on the horizon in those days. But what he had to say, I think, holds true in general, even though virtually nobody really pays any attention to it now. But in section 20, he says this. He says, it is strictly forbidden to have bands play in the church, and only in special cases with the consent of the ordinary, that's the bishop, will it be permissible to admit wind instruments, limited in number, judiciously used, and proportioned to the size of the place provided, the composition and accompaniment be written in grave and suitable style and conform in all respects to that proper to the organ, that are proper to the organ. His point here is that when you begin to introduce into the liturgical context what is profane, not in a sinful sense, but what is profane versus sacred, suddenly now you are in a way kind of profaning the Mass, because you're turning it into something, like he says, no bands, for example. And nowadays bands have drums and bass guitars and all that. So even though this is not the law of the church, it expresses a wise approach to liturgical music that virtually nobody pays any attention to anymore. So if you're interested in reading this, and it might be worth your time to take a look at it, it's called Tra le sollecitudini. And it's the instruction on sacred music from Pope Pius X. So I would say take a look at that. Now, this is a long-winded way of answering your question, which is, personally, I agree with Pope Pius X. I don't think it's helpful. This is perhaps one reason why I myself have an aversion to so-called praise and worship music. I play the bass guitar. I love the bass guitar. I love music that involves bass, drums, guitars, keyboards. That's the kind of music I really like. You can tell by listening to this program, because we play that kind of music all the time. But I do believe that Mass is not the proper setting for that kind of music. So a snare drum is just one piece of this bigger picture. The thing to remember, though, Raphael, is that since Vatican II, those sorts of norms were more or less ignored. And now the church does permit that kind of thing. And I know there are plenty of people who like that kind of thing. But nonetheless, I could see why that would be jarring to you if you hadn't seen that before. It's certainly not the kind of traditional music that you probably grew up with.
Well, thank you. That's a very good answer. And I will go talk personally to the priest and see what he says. But I got to bring, since you pronounced my name the way you did, I disagree with pronouncing it Raphael. Raphael, to me, is a painter. Raphael is the great archangel. And I would encourage people to, since he's the medicine of God, that a lot more people should pay a little attention to St. Raphael, because he's the medicine of God, and he can cure you of diseases and so forth, of maladies.
Mm-hmm. Here's something to think about, though, if you don't mind.
Well, thank you for your answer. God bless you for that answer. That was good. Very well said.
You're most welcome. Thank you for that. Just a little food for thought as a parting gift. Just remember that Raphael is an anglicized pronunciation of the Hebrew Raphael. So if you were to look at that word in Latin or Hebrew or Greek, it would not be pronounced Raphael. That's an English way of pronouncing it. And there's nothing wrong with it. But it's not the original pronunciation of the name. Yeah, just something to think about. Thank you. Let's go to, do we have time? I think we do. Let's go to Lynn in central Wisconsin. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Patrick. My husband and I have a Catholic nephew who married another man, so obviously he's not practicing his faith.
Okay.
And they want to be parents, so through in vitro, they are having a child, and our nephew's brother's wife is the surrogate. So we've been invited to the baby shower. Mm-hmm. So my question is, as practicing Catholics, do we go? Do we get a gift? What's the best policy?
This is, when you say a baby shower, this is not a baptism, right? This is just, hey, let's have a party because we have a new baby?
Well, so the baby isn't born yet, and I don't know the exact due date, but I would assume in a few months. So they're having the baby shower before.
Yeah, I wouldn't go. And the reason I wouldn't go is because, first of all, it would be... a tacit acknowledgement or condoning, I guess might be another way to put it, the arrangement that these two men are in, which is gravely sinful. And then it would also constitute a kind of tacit approval of another grave sin, which is the surrogate pregnancy. That's a grave, grave sin. The child is entirely innocent, of course. The child deserves love and acceptance and everything we would give to any other child under any other circumstance. The child certainly deserves all of that. So I'm not, the things I'm saying have nothing to do with this innocent young child. But by going and celebrating something like that, it's celebrating some really serious sinful activity. And so I wouldn't do that.
Okay, so that was our thinking as well. But of course, we do, you know, we know the child is innocent. So is there a way that we can celebrate that?
Well, I mean, okay, so now a child is in this world, and this child needs love and care and attention and pampers and all the other things that babies need. So you wouldn't be doing anything wrong at all if you were to provide some of those things for this child. You know, that in itself would not be sinful, because you're not doing something to help people commit a sin. This is after the fact. It would be no different, or let's just put it this way, it would be similar to if the child had been conceived in rape. And it's a terrible sin that was committed that brought this child into existence. And yet, if you were to look after this child, give gifts, try to help out, all those things, you're not doing it in any way to you know, say that the rape was okay. Far from it, obviously. You're doing something to help the child. So in a case like that, this is where, for me, I wouldn't go to a celebration of it. I would maybe send a gift, perhaps, for the baby. That would be good. But where it gets messy is if you're going to the party and everybody's celebrating and isn't this great, and you know in the back of your mind that this is not great, this is really a terrible situation that this now innocent child is brought into. Help the child, but don't celebrate the sins that led up to that, seems to me.
Okay, thank you so much, Patrick. That really helps a lot.
You're welcome. Yeah, life is difficult with some of these crazy situations, isn't it? Well, thanks, Lynn. I have to take a break, but I'll be right back. So please don't go anywhere. We receive hundreds of your phone calls every day, all thanks to the Catholic Order of Foresters studio line. Our sponsor offers flexible life insurance and annuities. Visit relevantradio.com/forester today. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Don't worry, be happy.
All right. All right.
I just thought after so. the barrage of bass as we're going to break,
to go
I was
to
like,
this.
I better go to something with no bass.
And you know, isn't all of this vocal? There's no actual
all
instruments.
All of it is vocal. It's all Bobby McFerrin. It's all coming out of his voice box.
And what sounds like a ukulele is actually him.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. This came out in the 80s, man.
That long ago?
Yeah, I think so. Let's go to Leo in Front Royal, Virginia. Hi, Leo.
Hello. How can I reach out? How can we reach out to the senators and representatives on the Respect for Any Kind of Pagan and Genetically Harmful Marriage Act, which they just passed, 12 senators, and at any age, any relationship, polygamy?
Yeah, it's like living in pagan Rome all over again. Well, I mean, if I understand your question correctly, Leo, you can email, you can call, you can write a letter, you can visit the office of the lawmaker if that's something you want to do. I'm not sure what you're asking me.
What kind of comment?
Well, I mean, you could say I object to this because this is immoral and wrong, and it's exploitative of children.
And genetically.
Pardon me?
Also genetically, because children, any age, any relationship, one child to another child, same family. parent, adult.
Yeah, child. It's terrible. It's terrible. And the one of the end game scenarios that they're working for, maybe not every individual politician, but the movement that they are helping to support, is seeking not just to lower the age of consent for children, but to eliminate it as much as possible.
And also,
it's reprehensible.
Also, it's also harmful because every state would have to accept any other state's rules.
Yeah, I know. It's a big mess. It's a big mess. So here is an example of what happens when people don't vote with a moral conscience and they vote for other reasons, like how much money am I going to get out of this, or other lesser motives. You get what you pay for. And we're living now with the results of generations of lazy, apathetic voting habits on the part of Catholics and others. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. They've been roosting for a long time. But this is yet more of the same devastating results from a lazy, apathetic, pig-headed way of voting on the part of countless people over many generations. This is not something we can...
And it would also weaken the military.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. Let's go to Maribel. Thanks for the call, Leo. Let's go to Maribel in Dallas. Good morning, Maribel.
Good morning. So my question is, when receiving Eucharist and people, I always try to receive on the tongue instead of the hand because I don't want to touch the body. But my question is, when the priest is finished and he sits back down, the altar boys come and they rinse his hands. Why don't the Eucharistic ministers do the same thing and wash their hands? They just go back to their pews after touching the body.
Because they were not properly taught. That's why. Because the oversight or the preparation, the formation for being an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion was not very thorough. And the reason, of course, that the priest washes his hands. Now, when you say washes, I think what you're referring to is typically a priest would purify his hands when he is cleaning out the chalice at the very end before Mass concludes. And part of cleaning the chalice is to eliminate any remaining particles of the Holy Eucharist and any residue of the precious blood, and also pouring the water over his fingers to remove any particles that might cling to his fingers. And that's all important and very good, because we don't want the real presence of the Lord now falling on the ground or in any other way not being shown respect. So a proper and thorough preparation and formation for the lay people who are going to do this should include that as well. That, it, you know, you go to the credence table, for example, and there would be a place where you could either dip your fingers in a basin of water or something like that. But this is one of the problematic side effects of an over-exaggerated use of extraordinary ministers for Holy Communion. It is necessary at times, and the Church does permit it. But I believe it's because what you're seeing is because they've never really been, it's never been explained to them. They've never been told. This is why you should make sure that there are no particles left on your fingers. So
I see. Well, thank you for the answer. Well, maybe I can ask the priest if they can get that proper training, but yeah. I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
You're welcome, Maribel. Thank you. We'll go now to Peter in Des Plaines, Illinois. Hi, Peter. Welcome.
Morning. I'll get right to the question. You just mentioned something about surrogate, the Church being against surrogate parents.
Right.
So that's a commodity question. Very quickly, I know there are people who do IVF, you know, the in vitro fertilization. I'm not sure exactly what it stands for. But
right.
Invariably, there are often many eggs, fertilized embryos left over. Like the parents, mm-hmm. maybe they want two kids, and maybe five eggs are embryos mm-hmm. now. So they use two. What happens to the other three? A few years ago, I became aware of a program where people can adopt the embryo, where you know, they adopt the embryo legally and all this, and I guess they put it in the mother, you know, who adopted it, and then it's a pregnancy and the child's born. What is, as much as this, you know, the embryos already exist, what's the Church's position on something like that?
Well, there's a debate about this, and I'll share a little bit about that in a moment. This is so new that it is not something the Church has really had enough time to to properly, what's the word I want, ponder and develop a very specific kind of approach to this. I think the general idea or the general stance on the part of the church would be no, that you can't do it. But the way the wording is, it leaves open. In fact, there's a phrase in the statement from the Vatican which says it seems as though there is no choice but not to adopt embryos. And that phraseology, to my mind, leaves open the door that there could be a change in the future, or at least moving in a different direction. So I would refer you to a book. It's helped me greatly. It's called Human Embryo Adoption, Biotechnology, Marriage, and the Right to Life. It's edited by Father Thomas Berg, and it is a compendium of the debate. So you've got a variety of, I think, really very insightful ethicists, Catholic moral theologians and others, who debate this issue in great detail. And personally, those who are strongly against the idea of embryo adoption, I don't think are really as persuasive as the case to be made for embryo adoption. Now, this is an open question, I believe. Some would say, no, the church has spoken on it. Well, the church has spoken on it to a certain extent, but in a way that suggests that there is a possibility that it could change, as I said earlier. So what I would say, Peter, if you want kind of the up-to-date, current state of the discussion, I would get a hold of this book, Human Embryo Adoption, Biotechnology, Marriage, and the Right to Life. And this is available at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. They also have in their quarterly journal, which I subscribe to, articles on an ongoing basis in which they discuss and debate this very issue. And I try to stay current on that as well. So you could either order the journal articles or order those volumes of the journals where they're discussing it, or you could just simply get this book, which brings together all the various voices that are coming from different directions on this topic. That's what I'd suggest.
Yeah, it just kind of seemed to me, I'd never heard of the church even addressing that topic, that angle of that topic. It kind of seems to me that the only option is for the embryo to be destroyed or killed or adopted. I mean, it almost seemed like a no-brainer in a way, although it is an unusual scenario. I mean, I understand that too. But yeah, no, I appreciate the help. Thank you.
You got it. I appreciate that too. And it's a topic that is obviously horrible because you've got these children who are on ice indefinitely. That's not, talk about an affront to their human dignity and not being given an opportunity to be born. It's just a terrible mess all the way around. This is yet another reason why the Catholic Church says that in vitro fertilization is a serious sin. Don't do it. Please don't do it. Even though you very much desire a child, and that's good. That's a good goal. Every parent, every married couple, I should think, would want to have children if possible. But this would be an illicit way of achieving a good goal, and it would be something immoral as a means of trying to achieve a good goal, and you know you can't do that. Let's go to Chris now in Vista, California. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. I have kind of like a three-in-one question. Just basically, how do Catholics traditionally celebrate the feast day of the King of Christ? And then is there any relation to Thanksgiving? And maybe is there any history of Thanksgiving being Catholic?
Okay, so we're talking about Christ, the feast day of Christ the King, number one. Well, the traditional way of celebrating it would be to have, of course, it's a universal feast day in the church, so you would have the Mass for that feast day and the readings and the music and all of the things that are associated with that. Sometimes there would be processions outside of some churches. Usually that's the way it's celebrated. Now, outside of Mass, you could celebrate the Feast of Christ the King in your home. You could have a special meal. You could, you know, toast if you want. Those are all things that you do. But the traditional way of doing that, at least as far as the parish is concerned, would be the Mass and the things associated with the Mass. Now, Thanksgiving, is that the next question? In other words, Thanksgiving as the holiday that we celebrate in the United States, is that what you mean?
Right. Exactly. I don't know if there's any kind of history being Catholic.
No, there's not, because remember that the pilgrims who, you know, they're understood to be kind of the progenitors of this Thanksgiving meal. And I know there are a lot of historical revisionists who want to say, well, that didn't happen that way, and all of the things you think happened didn't happen. Well, putting all that polemic aside, these were Puritans. These were Calvinists who had come to the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Now, there were many earlier settlers elsewhere, like the Catholics who came much, much earlier in Florida. But the celebration of Thanksgiving that we have as a holiday in the United States commemorates the Puritans and their interaction with the Native Americans in that place, and the meal that they had and how they shared, etc. So the historical foundation is definitely not Catholic. And those Puritans who came there, they were adamantly anti-Catholic. So in the colonies, the Catholic Church was forbidden. And that's because of the antipathy of these Puritans, these Calvinists, against the Catholic Church. So no Catholic connection to the celebration of Christmas, or to the celebration, sorry, of Thanksgiving as we know it, I'm afraid. I hope that helps, Chris. And yeah, we'll be celebrating Thanksgiving very soon as a holiday that we can all celebrate, Catholics, Protestants, and everyone else. It's a good reminder to be grateful to God for the things he's given us and to seek ways of being friends with each other, building bridges, so to speak. I wish I had more time, but unfortunately, I'm out of time right now. So once again, all the things that I talk about, typically articles or book recommendations or things, Cyrus gets those posted on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. You can find it all there. And in the meantime, until we're together again, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.
River Derrick.